This morning's sermon is intended as an introduction to the annual water communion ceremony. However, I must confess I have never participated in a water communion service, despite how popular they are in many of our congregations. I have, however, always appreciated the poetic and symbolic significance of water. For me, water is more than simply a metaphor. It is elemental and primary, calling forth feelings of awe and reverence, acknowledging that the ocean is considered by many to be the place from which all life on our planet came. It is the womb of life, and that amniotic waters surround each of us prenatally. Water represents and symbolizes the source of creation and recreation. Our reading this morning, the place of living waters, is not from the pagan Christ, but close. It's from the introduction to Tom Harper's other wonderful book, For Christ's Sake. It was created by its author to serve as a rich parable depicting with its metaphorical imagery of the clear spring of running water, the history of the Christian church, and the multitude of obstructions that have been created over 2,000 years to preserve the so-called purity of the spring from which flows the water of life. That we need to tear away these obstructions has been the call of the prophets from ancient times through the Protestant Reformation to the prophets of our own free faith, like Channing and Emerson, Rebecca Parker and Forrest Church, reminding us that we need to be diligent in our keeping the flow clear. In my search for other stories about the waters of life, I found that in the Jewish tradition, the place of living waters is depicted somewhat differently. For example, in the Old Testament story of Jacob, we read how Jacob plunges down into the deep ravine of the Jabbok River thousands of feet below. Reaching the strong river rushing at the bottom, he finds the place of crossing and sends his family and all his belongings on. And there Jacob waits, not sure for what, until an apparition appears and wrestles with him all through the night. At the sign of the first light, the figure attempts to flee, but Jacob holds on, saying, "I will not let thee go except thou bless me." Finally, the Spirit gives Jacob its blessing and vanishes as dawn floods the length of the river valley. The Spirit refuses to name itself, but Jacob knows he's seen the face of God. From that point on, Jacob is known as Israel, which is Hebrew for God wrestler. Here, too, we find the waters of life as the source of blessing. The essence of Jacob's journey awaits anyone who dares to search for God and who thinks truth might have something to do with it. For who among us in our heart of hearts can deny that such a profound ravine exists within us all, waiting for the instant we summon the courage to descend into our own depths? And against all our fears, at the base of this profound ravine is that portion of God's river, the waters of life, cutting through our deepest stone. According to Mark Nepo, in a wonderful little book, Facing the Lion, Being the Lion, Finding Inner Courage Where It Lives, he writes, "This ancient story seems to say if you can descend into your rock bottom, no matter what brings you there, you will find God's river. And at the place of crossing, if you put down all that you carry, if you send on all that you love, if naked of all attachment, you wait in your deepest rock through your darkest night, the Spirit of the universe, the Spirit of life will enfold you. And you will have the chance of a lifetime to turn and bend, to wrestle with the elusive being of the world. And then if you can hold on until there is a trace of fresh light, the ineffable will reveal itself to you, and that revelation will bless you, renew you, enable you to wade through God's river, the river of life, into the freshness of original living and new creation. This ancient parable of transformation is worth meditating on. I invite you to retell it while personalizing all the players, placing yourself as Jacob, naming your loved ones who travel with you, particularizing the landscape of your own ravine, describing the taste of God's stream, the waters of life, that you alone know, and putting a face and voice on the spirit that you wrestle with. Imagine your conversation with that spirit. Enter the parable again with all these personal faces and see what you can learn. This is how Scripture should be read if it is to come to life in our own lives, free of the corruptions of doctrine and dogma and literalism. At the heart of it, the story confirms that when we find ourselves in the middle of the desert or lost in the wilderness, at the bottom of our toughest troubles, there flows the eternal stream, God's river, the waters of life. The story tells us that by facing our own experience, there stepping into God's river, we will be forced into a baptism that confronts our deepest assumptions about life. It is important to note that in facing these things and wrestling with God, the purpose of the story points toward is not to conquer or pin God, but to take hold of what is essential and elusive at the heart of our experience and to stay in an embrace with it until it reveals its secrets and blesses our journey. Inevitably, we are given the chance again and again to face the river and enter the waters at the bottom of our ravine, where we will rise having grown wiser, knowing that suffering and loss is part of the unity of life. Perhaps some of you find my reflections this morning to be a little overburdened with too much God talk. In that case, let me share a poem with an atheist and Buddhist spiritual sensibility written by the great English poet Ted Hughes, a poet who clings to the raw and primal nature of life. It's titled How Water Began to Play, and it contains the same message of the stories we've heard. The poem is a story of water, kind of like you and I, wanting to live. How water began to play. Water wanted to live. It went to the sun. It came back weeping. Water wanted to live. It went to the trees, they burned, it came weeping back. Water wanted to live. It went to the flowers, they crumbled, it came weeping back. It wanted to live. It went to the womb, it met blood, it came weeping back. It went to the womb, it met maggots and rottenness, it came weeping back. It wanted to die. It went to time. It went through the stone door. It came weeping back. It went searching through all space for nothingness. It came weeping back. It wanted to die till it had no weeping left. It lay at the bottom of all things, utterly worn out, utterly clear. Water encounters suffering and loss throughout all of creation and weeps until there is no weeping left. Water lay at the bottom of all things, utterly worn out, utterly clear. That, too, is an expression of God's blessing or creation's blessing. The truth is that given enough time, life bestows its gifts, sometimes a drop at a time, oftentimes in the form of tears, but these gifts come only if we can find the courage to stay open to the mysterious flow, a flow that is larger than any one event. Let me offer you another wonderful story about our relation to the waters of life. In South America, there are sluice ways that flow down the mountainsides. They are called acequias. Each one provides water for a particular village, just as many American and European cities have been built along rivers throughout the ages. Many South American villages have settled around the mouth of an acequia that begins high up and out of sight in the crags of a mountain. There, the source water from the god seemingly collects all winter near the top, and in spring, with a thaw, it streams relentlessly into the village. When Wayne Mueller, author of How Then Shall We Live, traveled to South America, he lived with the Yanke Indians in a small pueblo in the mountains of south central Peru. There he learned of the importance of clearing the acequia. Wayne found himself in the middle of an annual ritual in which an entire village of 800 climbed the mountain in early spring to walk and clear the acequia, removing all the rocks and tree limbs and snake nests that during the winter had blocked the path of water that the village depended on. The ancient ritual provides a wonderful model of a meaningful practice as well as a strong metaphor of how to care for our connection to the source. In this story, we can see that the acequia, whose pattern down the mountains has been worn through the years, is the one direct path that keeps the village connected to the source element of water. The acequia is very much like our path of connection to spirit and oneness and to the source element that we call life force, which always seems to gather and replenish itself high and out of view. And if we live near the mouth of it, we are never wanting in times of need, but we must care for the acequia of spirit from which our souls need to drink. So keeping the acequia clear and flowing is a meaningful practice. Interestingly, the other side of life, everyday life, with its anxieties and unending demands, which is inevitable and not evil, gives rise to the erosion and debris that clutters the acequia during the winter. The stones and limbs that block the flow, as well as the nesting of smaller creatures. These serve as symbols of dead things that get in the way and smaller living things that take up residence smack in the middle of the flow. Wayne was amazed when walking the acequia with the villagers that they simply moved the nests of smaller animals. They didn't kill these creatures unless they were dangerous. And there's a powerful teaching in this. For during our recurring winters, many of the burdens we carry fall over or break off, and they clutter our connection to the source. The inner debris that blocks the path is endless. It could consist of almost anything that weighs us down, a debilitating memory of grief or a broken stone of low esteem. And so we must regularly walk our acequia of spirit and clear out the path. Even more telling are the snakes, the snake nests that take up residence in the acequia. These represent the poisonous tapeworms of the soul, the out-of-balance compulsions and addictions that keep us from being whole, like our insatiable hunger for power or celebrity. We simply can't let them live there. And when dangerous, when they refuse to go, when they strike at us, they must be starved, no longer fed with water from the source. Sometimes they have to be killed. The life of the acequia and our responsibility to keep its path of flow clear represent a cycle of erosion and cleansing that is intrinsic to everything living. Therefore, it bears learning how to do it well. The heart of this morning's worship service is an exploration of the many acequias that flow from the source, the many natural obstacles that tend to block the source, and the many rituals and practices by which people throughout the ages have cleared the path of flow. One more thing is the model of true community that the people of this small village in Peru have given us. Whether the water coming down that mountain is actual water or the stream of a nation's reverence for life, the caring of the acequia and the sharing of the abundant flow when it comes is something that we in our modern sophistication has forgotten how to do in so many respects. This is reflected in a very powerful poem by the American poet Denise Levertov. The poem is called The Stricken Children. The wishing well was a spring, bubbling clear and soundless into a shallow pool, less than 3 feet across, a hood of rocks protecting it, smallest of grottos from falling leaves. The pebbles of past wishes peacefully underwater, old desires forgotten or fulfilled. No one threw money in. One had to search for the right small stone. This was the place from which year after year in childhood I demanded my departure, my journeying forth into the world of magical cities, mountains, otherness, the place which gave what I asked and more, to which still wandering I returned this year, as if to gaze once more at the face of an ancient grandmother. I found the well, filled to the shallow brim with the debris of a culture's sickness, with bottles, tins, paper, plastic, the soiled bandages of its aching consciousness. Does the clogged spring still moisten the underlayer of waste? Children who don't dream or dismiss their own desires and toss them down discarded packaging. I move away, walking fast. The impetus of so many journeys pushes me on. But where are the stricken children of this time, this place, to travel to? In time, if not in place. The grandmother wellspring choked and themselves not aware of all they are doing without. Yes, we in our modern sophistication have forgotten how to care for the wellspring, the place of living waters, and have polluted the water of life. Often we can feel the spirit underneath our habits, our bad habits, and deep down we know that though the ways we have chosen have lost their freshness, our blood is fine. It's the way we clog it up that sneaks up on us. Being human, experience itself clogs up the sacred opening of self. Without facing ourselves, the self remains filmed over and small, and very little gets through, and even that essential trickle stops touching us. It is only through the rinsed out self that we can experience compassion and truth. For sure, love and suffering can rinse out the self, but love and suffering too can be siphoned through, over, and around our walls. What saves us from ourselves is the power of our own honest gaze, which remains a cleansing agent that can wash out whatever thickens within us and wash off whatever grows over us. As a cleansing agent, self-reflection is indispensable to staying fully alive. We wouldn't think of going more than a few days without washing and showering. So think of facing ourselves as spiritual hygiene. For the clogged up self is the petty self, the one who ventures into the world and only finds me. But the cleansed self is the transparent self, the one who feels the aliveness and pain in everything. This is the self that serves as an inlet to the world, always feeling what moves through. Maintaining our transparent self is hard work. Critical self-reflection can be bruising to one's ego and self-idealization. To avoid this challenge, we narrow our inlet and cover our openings, making ourselves less vulnerable to life itself. So let me tell one final story. A story shared with me by an old friend whose family, when he was a boy, owned an old farmhouse in New Hampshire. Every summer, he and his family would spend a month in their old farmhouse. The house was 150 years old when it first came into his family's hands and had never been modernized. His father was the minister of a modest-sized church, and they were always short of money. So for a long time, they lived in the house quite simply, without the benefit of modern plumbing or electricity. The water supply during those years was an old well that stood just outside the front door. The water from the well was unusually cold and pure and a joy to drink, and the well was remarkable because it never ran dry. Even in the severest summer droughts, when other families would be forced to resort to the lake for their drinking water, the old well faithfully yielded up its cool, clear water. Eventually, the day came when the family fortunes improved and it was decided to modernize the house. Electricity now replaced the old kerosene lamps. An electric stove took over from the ancient kerosene burner, and modern plumbing and running water were installed. This necessitated a modern well, and accordingly, a deep artesian well was drilled a few hundred feet from the house. And no longer needed, the old well near the front door was sealed over to be kept in reserve should an occasion arise when, for some reason, the artesian well would not suffice. And so things stood for several years until one day, moved by curiosity and old loyalties, my friend determined to uncover the old well to inspect its condition. As he removed the cover, he fully expected to see the same dark, cool, moist depths he had known as a boy. But he was due for a shock, for the well was bone dry. It took my friend many inquiries on his part to understand what had happened. A well of this kind is fed by hundreds of tiny underground rivulets, along which seeps a constant supply of water. As water is drawn up from the well, more water moves into it along the rivulets, keeping these tiny apertures clear and open. But when such a well is not used and the water is not regularly drawn, the tiny rivulets close up. The well, which had run without failing for so many years, was dry not because there was no water, but because it had not been used. And we are like that well. And what happened to that old well can happen to all of us. It takes courage to keep the asakia of spirit unblocked. It takes discipline and a continuing practice of drawing from the well if we are to keep the waters of life flowing into us. We can dry up. Our souls can dry up. We can become brittle, narrow-minded, closed off. And what is true for us as individuals is also true for us as a religious community. This church, it too can dry up if it does not constantly challenge us to step naked into God's river, teaching us how to kneel so that we can drink from the water of life and receive its cool, startling benefits. We gather here on Sunday morning by the river to remember how to do so, knowing there is nothing like the wetness of life on our unexpected, dry, parched lips.